all three. And I need a little bit of a kick in the pants, you know, and that's what I get from Guy. Because he is in the ultimate common sense of the in a voting booth, at a ballot box. Dose of that once in a while. I sincerely do. Because when I see John McCain telling you that he is already out there looking for another Samuel Alito, I get cold chills down my spine. I mean, I get the little drops of sweat that form at the back of your hairline and run dribbling down your back and stop in the small of it and sort of make you cringe all over when I think of John the McCain-Churian McCain did it on January the 20th, 2009, putting his hand on some Bible and saying, "So help me God, I'll protect and defend the Constitution of the United States so long as it doesn't annoy my corporate owners." But that's me. I have nightmares about it. I have a very, very active dream life. I fall asleep and my overactive id or subconscious or what the hell ever's driving the bus when my eyelids are closed and my eyeballs are going back and forth like brrrr. I get that some nights when I'm nice and relaxed, I get little mind movies all night long in living color that are just fun. And I wake up and I go, hell, I couldn't have got that paying $10 at the movie theater. But other nights I sit bolt upright because I've just had a dream of President McCain. And I got to walk around the house for a little bit or come back here into the studio and just sort of scratch my head and sit for a little bit so the nightmare won't come back when I close my eyes again. Really? Oh, and those judges that McCain's talking about that make strict constructionist decisions as opposed to judges operating their Fiat or John Deere or Hollis Chalmers or whatever it is they're operating. They are voting, in fact, in North Carolina and Indiana today. And in South Bend, Indiana, well, if you haven't been paying attention, there's a pretty hefty Roman Catholic community in South Bend. They've got this little school there. You know, the one that plays football and could be like 3-12 and there would be people in the United States voting them number one in the national polls. You know, Notre Dame. Three and 12? No. 3-9. 3-12 is too much to hope for. No, but, there's a significant Roman Catholic community there. There's even a nunnery. You know, get thee to a nunnery, go. And that nunnery, being like most convents in the United States, has a lot more older nuns than younger ones. And you know, of course, that Indiana is the state that recently had the voter ID law held up by that fat freak Scalia and his buddy Alito and his buddy Roberts and his buddy Thomas, that said that old, old people who have never had to drive a car nor never needed a driver's license can be compelled to get some sort of photo ID in order to be able to cast the vote and exercise the franchise that their generation fought, bled, and died to preserve. About 12 nuns there in Indiana got turned away from a polling place by their fellow sister because they didn't have a state or federal photo ID. We're talking about St. Mary's Convent in South Bend, Indiana, right across the street from the place that has the touchdown Jesus and the gold dome. Turned away a 98-year-old nun. Not a single one of the dozen nuns operates a motor vehicle. Some of them showed up with outdated passports in an attempt to exercise their franchise. 98 years old? Good God, she was a child when the right to vote was finally won for women in this country. And she has lived long enough, yea, verily, to see it given and to see it taken away. Holy cow. They weren't given provisional ballots because it would be impossible to get them to a motor vehicle branch and back in the 10-day time frame allotted by the law. Sister Julie McGuire said. Sister Julie McGuire, of course, is the one who turned them away and told them they could not, in the name of God, vote because their papers were not in order. You have to remember, she said, that some of these ladies don't walk well. They're in wheelchairs or on walkers or electric carts. There is no indication whatsoever that any one of these nuns was trying to perpetrate what the Supreme Court speciously noted was the purpose of this hateful Indiana statute, to wit, voter fraud. But they were disenfranchised just the same. Now, we know, for instance, that Fat Tony Scalia and four other members of the Supreme Court are Roman Catholic. But Fat Tony Scalia, in particular, is a member of Opus Dei that thinks women are dung. Opus Dei, whose founder, who was made a saint by John Paul II, way to go, JP! Hitler could not possibly have killed 6 million. At most, it was 4 million Jews. He's a member of that order. A lay member of that order, Fat Tony Scalia is. They like to whip themselves and beat themselves and wear little barbed wire bracelets around their thighs so they can bleed like Jesus. And he, by his actions, took the vote away from women that his own faith declares to be brides of Christ. How's that working out for you, Fat Tony? I think that's going to take some extra candles while you're sitting there getting the fat toasted off your ass in purgatory, old boy. There's going to be some penance, baby. And you know how it goes in purgatory. I mean, all kinds of nasty stuff. Democracy in action. And John McCain has told you to your face that he wants more judges who will do more evil crap like that to people who, at the age of 98, cherish their right to vote as much or more as they do their next breath. If I didn't have a little bit more, just the tiniest bit less restraint than what I've got, I'd be dropping F-bombs all over the place because, you know, I loathe, I despise seeing old folks get crapped on by the likes of Fat Tony Scalia and the repig-licking party that he serves and that he confuses for Almighty God. But I'm just crazy that way. Let's go to the phones. Or not. So, you know, that's the first voter story of the evening. Now, bear in mind, our good buddy Brad Friedman has said that something like a million names have already been removed from the voter rolls? Yeah, I'm sorry. I understated. 1.1 million names were purged from Indiana voter registration rolls. Brad writes, in addition to the recent outrageously bad decision by the Supreme Court to approve Indiana's draconian polling place photo ID restrictions, sure to keep thousands of legal voters from even being able to cast a vote in tomorrow's, because he wrote this yesterday, important primary election, despite the state's inability to offer up a single instance of in-person polling place voter impersonation that's ever occurred during the state's entire history, another 1.1 million voters have now been purged from the voting rolls altogether. What's more, the state is using touchscreen voting machines across the state. Some of those machines, one in particular made by MicroVote, has been decertified. They're going to vote on them anyway. Several universities have proven that the ES&S and Diebold machines have been found vulnerable to undetectable vote-flipping viruses. Yeah, Lordy. Can you imagine a veteran of the Second World War who no longer drives being denied his right to vote by the actions of those people that John McCain thinks are upstanding judicial strict constructionists? Have you noticed you have to hiss like a snake to say strict constructionists? Oh, I'm informed by our pal Marty that all five of the Roman Catholics on the Supreme Court of the United States are Opus Dei. All five of them are into the little barbed wire thing and the whips and the bleeding for Jesus and all of that freaky stuff. All five of them hold women in the lowest regard. Just need one more we can really count on. And we can pull the Repig-Licking Party can pull down 150 years of social progress in this country. Roe v. Wade, Griswold versus Connecticut, they've already started on Brown versus Board of Education. What comes next? A ringing endorsement of the Dred Scott decision? Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. Our buddy David in South Carolina says, I have it from a pretty good source that this is one election the Dems are not going to sit around and play defense. There are some great plans in the works to swift boat McNutt. I know we're supposed to be above this, but this plan is in the works as I type. Some of them have to do with his spiritual advisors. Trust me, you're going to love this. Ooh, I want you to be right, David. Because seeing the McCain-Churian candidate get a pass on the crazies that he runs around with from the religion industry is driving me a little bit maddy. But you'll have that from time to time, especially from the likes of me, who, you know, I take this stuff far too seriously. I need to take a walk. From time to time, I've heard our buddy and hero Mike Malloy talk about, you know, earlier in the day, he goes and gets a swim. That's sounding like a better and better idea, and I can't wait till the county 4-H grounds open their swimming pool sometime around the middle of June. Used to be swimming pools opened on Memorial Day, but not around here, not when the county budget's been slashed to near nothing. And you can have a county financial crisis just trying to fill up a couple of damn swimming pools. Oy. But going and having a little swim, I kind of like that a lot. So that's where we begin this evening. We, God knows, are off to a roaring start. What about your thoughts? What about where you are with all of this? You want to share it? Don't be shy. We've never lost a caller yet. So we'll take a little break. We'll come back. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, toll free. 304-658-3333 if you've got your own unlimited long-distance dialing plan and you want to save us a buck or two. That's fine, too. Email rolls into Bob at headonradio.com. Learn it, know it, use it. We'll be back. This is The Horn. Talking Heads, City of Dreams. I love the Talking Heads. Tell you what, we're going to the phones right quick, but I just want to share something that just rolled in. Again, our buddy Brad Friedman over at bradblog.com reporting a couple of highly disturbing things. First of all, the whole nun incident in Indiana began with a first-time voter, 18 years of age, at St. Mary's College in South Bend, thrilled to be voting in her first presidential election. All she had was a private college ID, and that ain't good enough to let you vote in Indiana. And it was after dealing with that problem that the poll worker nun realized she was going to have to disenfranchise some nonagenarian members of her order.
Be swept out of office. You may not be in
at all. She's not going to get to an old rely on government so much that they don't work for themselves. So, in other words, the health. Let's try to bring this country together. I think Obama can still do it. And I like the fact that in his speech last night, he talked about the distractions. He was not naive. He understood that the Republicans were going to go very negative. And he's kind of drawing the sting. There's an old trial lawyer tactic that if you know that something is bad on your side, your client has done something wrong or something won't look good to the jury, you don't let the other side bring it up first. You bring it up first, and then by the time the other side brings it up, well, it's old news. Well, Obama is bringing up that the Republicans are going to go negative. He's telling you ahead of time. He needs to say it every single day. Republicans always fight dirty. Republicans always fight dirty. Republicans always fight dirty. And then when they do, people will see it for what it is. At least I hope so. But he's got to keep saying it. And in the off chance they won't, well, forget the off chance. That possibility is 0%. They will fight dirty. And Obama needs to remind us of that possibility. One thing I did find interesting, and it relates to yesterday's show as well, was the disagreement between Obama and Clinton on the gas tax. And there are issues where I support Clinton over Obama. I actually think her health care program is better than his. I've talked about times where I agree with her over him. But on the gas tax, he's 100% right. She really is pandering. And as we learned yesterday from Tyson Slocum in Public Citizen, and it's not just him, folks. Even if you don't like him, every single economist that has examined this will tell you that if you get rid of the gas tax, the oil companies will still charge the 18 cents. They'll just keep it for themselves. In other words, it's a net transfer of wealth, a further transfer of wealth, a greater transfer of wealth from taxpayers to oil companies. Haven't we had enough of that? Oh, Hillary Clinton will tell you. She'll tell you, well, but I also want a windfall profits tax, which is great, which Obama wants too. But what she didn't say is that I will only lower the gas tax if I get the windfall profits tax. It's a package deal, not one without the other. And that's why she's pandering. Because she knows that a Republican Congress would get rid of the gas tax in a second as long as all the money went to the oil companies, but would not agree to windfall profits tax. So she's kind of talking out of both sides of her mouth. Here she supports something that doesn't really help, that doesn't help anyone, that sounds good, that is true pandering, doesn't help anyone, along with something that's quite good, making these extremely wealthy oil companies pay their fair share in taxes. But she didn't link them. And Obama was right that he was pandering, that she was pandering, and he also, I think, stands out for not telling the American people what they want to hear. By the way, McCain supports the gas tax, too. Getting rid of the gas tax, he's just as much of a panderer as Hillary Clinton, indeed, far more so in many other ways. But Obama stood firm, even though he knew that it might look bad. And I think people respected that. I really do. So we go on. West Virginia, Kentucky, Oregon. I'll give you the conventional wisdom. You probably know it. West Virginia goes for Hillary Clinton. Kentucky goes for Hillary Clinton. And so that it's every state around Ohio, bordering Ohio, goes for Hillary Clinton. Oregon, the western states, Oregon, Montana, South Dakota, all go for Obama. Puerto Rico goes for Hillary, is the conventional wisdom. And then where are we? We're right where we are now. Obama needs 100, will need 100 delegates or so, and she'll need 200 delegates or so, and she's not going to get two-thirds of the superdelegates. There are interesting scenarios that, as a historian, as someone who loves watching politics, I kind of like to see. Now, as a Democrat, I just want Obama to win and it be over, so we can focus on the general election. But I have to admit, as a historian, little things like that fall through the cracks, they interest me. Part of me would have been pleased as punch to have a 269-269 electoral tie in the last election. Now, most of me would have been upset because I know that at that time the House of Representatives had a majority of Republican state delegations. It probably still does today. I don't know if you know this. If there's a tie, the 12th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says that the House shall vote by state. So it's by number of states that decide the tie. So California gets one vote, and New York gets one vote, and Wyoming gets one vote. And so the 500,000 people of Wyoming get the same vote as the 30 million people of California. Maybe not the best system. Our founders weren't perfect. But part of me would have just liked to have seen the process. One of the things I enjoyed, frankly, in 2000 was writing the brief challenging the Florida electors and studying the process very thoroughly and learning, for example, that there was no time limit for counting electoral votes until they were actually counted. Supreme Court, of course, was just wrong. They were wrong on the law, wrong on the facts. We've talked about that decision before. But it was interesting for me going through the process, learning how you do challenge an elector. And so part of me thinks it would be interesting if, well, the votes are so close that the little things make the difference. For example, you ever wonder about John Edwards' delegates? If you look at the North Carolina results, you'll see that they don't add up to 100%. The Indiana results do, 51-49, that's 100%. In North Carolina, it's 56-42, it adds up to 98. Where's the 2%? This is North Carolina. There's still some fans of John Edwards out there. John Edwards won 61 delegates. Now, about half of those, through the processes of the various states, and if you want me to explain how this works, I will, but basically it's through precinct conventions and then congressional district conventions and state conventions. The old Edwards delegates, half of them already have chosen one side or the other. But there's still 25 outstanding Edwards delegates. Maybe John Edwards is hoping that that 25 makes the difference. It's not inconceivable. It's highly unlikely, but not inconceivable. Can you imagine John Edwards selling his 25 delegates for a vice presidential slot? Okay. Unlikely. But still fun to imagine. In my perfect imaginative world, the one that I know won't happen, but it's the kind of thing that, hey, at night makes a really good dream, the superdelegates split so that neither candidate has a victory, which is certainly possible, unlikely, but possible. And a few of the Edwards delegates, maybe, or a few of the undecided superdelegates, vote for a candidate who I prefer over Obama or Clinton. His name is Al Gore. And can't you imagine there's a first ballot, and Obama gets 2023, and Clinton gets, 1996, and you need 2025, and then another 25 delegates vote for Al Gore. It is possible, not probable, but fun to think about. And then they have another vote. This time 100 delegates go to Gore, and then 200, and then 400. And soon by the 23rd ballot, Al Gore becomes the Democratic nominee. He chooses Barack Obama as his vice presidential nominee, as the person who won the most delegates and pledge votes. And we have the unbeatable team for November. Okay, I'm just dreaming. But hey, I endorsed Gore Obama a year ago as my dream ticket. So, I can dream. Let me go to the phone lines. We've got Gene on the line. Gene, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, Mark. How's it going?
It's going okay. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, it was really the one thing you haven't discussed, maybe you haven't discussed because you probably think it's a load of hooey and that kind of thing, but there's the whole thing, especially on the mess about this Operation Chaos or whatever it is, a certain Republican broadcaster wants to implement. And I've seen that, and I'm kind of annoyed about it, and I just...
Gene, let's be clear what you're talking about. I think what you're talking about is Rush Limbaugh telling people to vote for Hillary Clinton, but if you're talking about something else, let me know.
That's what it is. And initially, before you mentioned the Obama-Gore scenario, which that sounds very good, and that I would actually...
It's going to be wrong, Gene. I don't think it's going to happen. It's a dream of mine. I would never... I would never bet on it.
Oh, I know, but you see, short of that, that's the only, the idea of a floor fight. I mean, I'm looking at an article right now where McGovern is urging Clinton to drop out, and I personally think that she should, because it makes it look really bad. It makes it look bad for her. The longer it she stays in, and the more it hurts the party, because people that are just lukewarm Obama supporters or prefer Obama over Clinton without the animosity, this is going to make them feel like they're with the Operation Chaos thing. And if Clinton stays in there, it's going to make it look like she's kind of the Republicans' choice for the Democratic nomination.
I'll tell you, I think she should drop out too, but I think she needed an excuse. If Indiana, the irony is, if Indiana, if 10,000 votes had switched places, and that's all it would have taken because there was a less than 20,000 vote margin, if 10,000 votes had switched places, 1% of Indiana had changed places, and Obama had won Indiana, then I think Hillary Clinton would have dropped out. But even though the difference of 1% changes nothing in the delegate lead, it changes at maximum 2 delegates, 4 delegates. She doesn't have the excuse she needs to drop out. Now, if she loses West Virginia, if Obama wins West Virginia, that's the end of Hillary Clinton's campaign. But I don't think he will. But if he does, it's over.
Well, but the thing of it is, with the story going around about this Operation Chaos, those 10,000 votes are going to look like Republican votes that have switched to Democratic votes, just to, you know, to keep
to mess with them. Well, I'll tell you this. In West Virginia, there was a Republican caucus already. So I would bet that West Virginia doesn't let them vote twice. Bob would know that. You can ask him. But, you know, in Mississippi, when you have the primaries on the same day, I mean, there's no need for Republicans to vote anymore. Their nominee is for certain. And that's why I think, you know, Rush Limbaugh did have an effect. I'll tell you this, though, as I read the polls, and not that people always tell the truth to pollsters, because they don't, but they seem to show that a lot of the Republicans in the race, there were about 5% of the votes in Indiana were from Republicans, and about half of them said that they would vote for Clinton in the fall but would vote for McCain over Obama. And the other half of the Republicans half the Republicans voted for Obama, which is important, and the other half voted for Clinton. But of the Clinton supporters, half said they'd go back to McCain, and half of those, which we're talking now a very small number, said that they would continue. They just came in basically to muck up the process. So again, I don't know that people would admit that. I had strongly considered voting for Huckabee in Virginia, because at that time Huckabee was the only way to stop McCain. Not that I like Huckabee, but that my feelings about Obama versus Hillary have never been very strong. I endorsed Obama, but my endorsement's been, I'll tell you, I began my endorsement lukewarmly for Obama, slightly favoring him. As time has gone on, I've liked him more and more, and I've liked her less and less, largely because of the way they've conducted the campaign, not really because of the issues per se. I still think they're very close on the issues, but because I think that his tone is more measured than hers.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much how I feel. I mean, I like how he's run his campaign. Now, on his issues, I wish he were a little more left on certain things than he is right now, like his stance toward the oil companies and such. But I'll choose him over McCain any day, because...
Well, now, how is Obama not tough enough on the oil companies, in your view?
Well, from what I understand, he doesn't really care to And that might be wrong.
He supports a windfall profits tax, as does Hillary Clinton.
I was under the impression that he didn't.
Go to his website. He does, and he supports helping wind and solar companies with subsidies. The one thing Obama did wrong, in my view, on energy, is he did vote for the bad Republican energy bill of 2005, and I've condemned him for that. Hillary voted the right way. That's one thing that I think she got right and he got wrong. In his defense, he says that he did it because it provided some subsidies for wind and solar, and it did. But I think that the negative parts of the bill outweighed the positive. I think it gave too much to the oil companies. But understand that the 2005 bill was written by the Republicans, for the Republicans, for the oil companies, and the wind and solar was thrown in the sweetener, and Obama had to vote yes on something good and bad or no on something good and bad. As president, I think he wouldn't be forced to make that difficult choice. Now, I think he made the wrong choice. But again, as president, I think he and a Democratic Congress, he could have the right choice. So I don't think he's that different.
All right. Well, you know, like I said, it could be wrong. So I'll take your word for it because the computer.
Well, take a look. Go to his website. Listen, I could have gotten it wrong myself. And if I'm wrong, you know, let me know. But my impression is that he does support a windfall profits tax. He does talk often about, you know, the power of rich corporations as much as Hillary does. I actually don't think there's much daylight between them on that issue. I do think he was right to keep the gas tax, and she's wrong on that. Definitely on that issue.
Okay, well, then I'll go ahead and check, and I'll text in the chat room if either one of us are mistaken.
Yeah, now check it out. And meanwhile, you and I can perform a very quiet draft Al Gore campaign that I'm sure is too little and too late, but I still I still want a Gore Obama ticket. I won't be pissy, to use my negative word. Obviously, if I don't get my first choice, which is Al Gore, I will happily vote for the Democratic nominee in the fall.
I think
both Hillary and Obama are much better than John Kerry. Both of them.
Oh, definitely. Anyway, I will let you go so other people can call in.
Thanks. I appreciate that, Gene. I appreciate your call. I'll take a quick break so others can call in if they want to. When we come back, I want to talk about Mildred Loving and the famous 1967 case of Loving v. Virginia and what relevance this case that struck down interracial marriage has for today. The toll-free number, 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Right back after this.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Barack Obama maintained his delegate and popular vote lead in the Democratic presidential primaries with a resounding victory in North Carolina Tuesday night. As he told of his grandparents and parents' hard work in an America that once offered real opportunity and hope for working people, he offered his vision for America's future.
It was an America that didn't just reward wealth, but it rewarded work and the workers who created it. That's the America I love. That's the America you love. That's the America that we are fighting for in this election.
Speaking to her supporters as she led Obama in the Indiana Democratic primary voting, Hillary Clinton said she's seen firsthand in this campaign the struggles that working Americans face.
I see you and I hear you, and I know how hard you're working for yourselves and working for your families. And I will never stop fighting for you so that you can have the future you deserve.
A union representing 60,000 workers is planning a big move. Jesse Russell reports.
The International Union of Electronic Workers has been based out of Washington, D.C. for more than half a decade. On Tuesday, the union, representing 60,000 workers at companies like General Electric and Delphi, announced it would be moving its base to somewhere in or around Dayton, Ohio, so it could be closer to the majority of its membership. The IUE is part of the Communication Workers of America, and the CWA will continue to be headquartered in D.C.
Letter carriers are once again helping to fill the nation's food banks, pantries, and shelters. May 10th has been proclaimed National Association of Letter Carriers Food Drive Day, and postal carriers and volunteers will be collecting non-perishable food items left by mailboxes in all 50 states. In New York City, where mailbox pickups of non-perishable food items is logistically difficult, residents are invited to drop off donations all this week at local post offices or through online donations to local food banks. Now here's Jesse Russell with Wynn's Economic Report.
If you buy a Chrysler, you could receive a gas subsidy. The automaker is offering to cap the price of gasoline at $2.99 per gallon for 3 years for individuals who purchase a Chrysler, Dodge, or Jeep between today and June 2nd. Customers receive a special card that, when used, will bill the charge as $2.99 per gallon. Will other car makers follow suit? Not GM or Ford. Spokespeople for those two companies said they plan to focus on developing fuel-efficient vehicles.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. It's the Week in Review. All topics are valid. I'd like to have you show so that if anything's on your mind, you're welcome to call in and comment. You can comment on yesterday's show or the show before or last week or some news or just something on your mind. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Got Lilo on the line. Lilo, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Well, hello, Mark. How are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, but I had two questions for you.
Okay. Go for it.
One you've already answered. It was regarding John Edwards' delegates. I sort
yes.
of missed that in the news. But my second question was, if we want Hillary to step aside soon, before the convention, is there anyone with your inside knowledge? Is there anyone who is influential enough, powerful enough, to talk to her and tell her that it is time to step aside?
Well, let me deal with your second question first. I think that the easiest way to get Hillary to step down is an event. If she loses a primary she's meant to win, it's over. If she loses West Virginia, I think it's over. If she loses Kentucky a week later, then I think it's over. Maybe if she loses Puerto Rico, then I don't think people will focus on Puerto Rico that much. As far as influential people, a lot have tried. The only two that I can think of, and I'm not so sure that either one of them would be effective, but the two that I think would be most effective are, one, John Edwards, who I think could sway his delegates. It's not many. It's not enough to put Obama over the top, but it's enough to make a difference. You know, 25 is you know, that's mm-hmm. a pretty big little, you know, in terms of when you think about that, Montana only has about 25. I mean, it's like a whole state John Edwards yeah. has. And given that states have proportional voting where, you know, if you win 60% of Montana, you only win four. Heck, you know, if you win 60% of a much bigger state like Kentucky or Oregon, you probably only win 20. John Edwards is as important as a state, and he hasn't endorsed anyone yet. I think that his role could be important. And the other person is, I think, the elder statesman of the Democratic Party. No, I'm not talking about Bill Clinton, though certainly if he told her to quit, I think she would listen. But he won't do that. He would be extremely criticized for not supporting his wife. No, I mean, of course, Al Gore, who I've always been a big fan of, and I've been a longtime fan of Al Gore, not a perfect man, but the best we've got. If he were to come out publicly, and but I also think the best way to do this is not public. I don't think you embarrass her. I think you call her privately. Whether John, for example, John Edwards could call her up and say, Hillary, I really think it's time for you to leave. I'd love for you to do it, and you know, then I won't. We'll never talk about this phone call. But if you don't, then I'm going to publicly announce and urge my delegates to support Obama. I think Al Gore, again, the proper way to do this, the respectful way to do this, is you start it privately and you say, I really think it's time for you to end. your campaign, but if not, I'll go public. Those, I think, are the two most powerful voices apart from her husband. But at the end of the day, the easiest way to get her out, if she had just lost Indiana yesterday, I think she would have ended her campaign. If she loses West Virginia next week, she'll end her campaign. If she loses Kentucky the week after. But as long as she keeps winning where she's expected to win and losing where she's expected to lose, she still won't win, but she doesn't have the reason to give her supporters to quit.
That is true.
Did I answer your question about the Edwards delegates? I hope I did. If not, I'll be more specific.
You answered it earlier. I didn't know how many were left and what.
Well, he got 61. Mm-hmm. But the way the delegate process works, it's extremely complicated. It's something that I think the Democratic Party does in a ridiculous fashion. Arguably, it's too Democratic. You know, they're so careful to be so Democratic in the sense of precinct level and then district level and then, you know, county level and then district level and then state level. And then you have one man and one woman. They have to be 50% each and they have to be proportional each. And they're so careful to be so Democratic that I actually think they go a little too far and it gets convoluted. But the way it works is Edwards actually won 61 delegates. But because delegates are really only chosen for one level, like in Iowa, for example, the Iowa caucuses, they only chose delegates for the precinct level. And then those delegates have to vote and then for the county level. And then those delegates have to vote for the congressional district level. And then those delegates have to vote for the state convention. No, it really is. I'm not making this up. I wish I were. Because of that, once Edwards dropped out of the race, many of those Edwards delegates, indeed, a little more than half of them, have already been deflected one way or the other to Obama or to Clinton. So of the 61 he had, he really only has about 25 left, and that's just the vagaries of the various states and so forth. So his power to be a kingmaker or queenmaker has definitely diminished because of this silly process.
And that was perfectly legal and proper to do.
That's part of the process. Absolutely, it may be a convoluted, crazy process, but no rules were broken. That's sort of the natural way it works. It's kind of like when you think about it, the caucus system to begin with, where if you don't get 15%, then the candidates go somewhere else. For example, Kucinich told his people that if he didn't get 50% in a district, to go caucus with the Edwards supporters. Yeah, I mean that's perfectly normal. The delegates do not have to vote. Even an Obama delegate, like a electoral college, doesn't have to vote the way that they say they're going to. You could vote for an Obama delegate. That person could register as an Obama delegate, and that person could vote for Clinton or Gore or Mickey Mouse, anyone else. Just like I was just going to say, just like at the national level, and this is where it gets really scary, you could pull the lever for President of the United States. In 2000, the District of Columbia voted overwhelmingly for Al Gore. Uh-huh. And two of those delegates, the District of Columbia has three electoral votes, two voted for Gore, and the third one voted, I think chose not to vote, to protest the fact that the District of Columbia doesn't have representation in Congress. Now, no one fights more for D.C. representation than I do, but I'm still pretty mad at that delegate, because that delegate, as far as I'm concerned, shouldn't have had a choice. He or she, I think it was a she, was chosen to represent Gore, and, you know, she shouldn't be playing around like that. But that's our crazy system. It's in the Constitution, and it's all perfectly legal, even though it's really an anachronism and needs to change.
Yeah, it defeats the whole purpose of the primary, right?
I mean, I think so.
Don't the primaries take place so that delegates are apportioned to the various candidates, and finally...
I think so. Now there is I'm trying to remember the DNC rule on this, and I don't remember. I believe the rule is now, and I could be wrong on this, so if I am, I'm sorry. I think the rule is now that your first vote, you must vote for the candidate you're committed for, but not the second, third, and fourth vote. And actually, you shouldn't be committed for 42 votes because you need to have a majority. And you can imagine where you have a race where there's three candidates that are very close, and there's no majority. And so, as I said, it could come, it's theoretically possible that, you know, Obama gets 2,000 votes, and Hillary Clinton gets 1,950 votes, and John Edwards gets 25, and Gore gets 20, and no one gets a majority. It's possible. And then at the second vote, everyone would be free to vote for whoever they want. It is extremely unlikely, but it is conceivable.
Mm-hmm. Now, I personally really prefer this proportional type of allotment, rather than a winner-take-all, because it sort, it mirrors the popular vote much better than a winner-take-all type primary or election, for that matter.
I support something in between.
Yeah.
I don't mind. What I would do is say, give a quarter of the delegates as a pure take-all, and then maybe to the other three quarters proportionally. And what that does is it ends a longer process. I mean, it makes winning a state matter, whereas right now winning a state really doesn't matter at all. I mean, Hillary Clinton won Indiana by, if she got 1% less, she would have gotten 1% less delegates. She wouldn't have won the state, and it wouldn't matter. And I don't mind giving some bonus, if you will, to people who win the state. It leads us to get a nominee sooner, and I understand that.
Yeah. I'm not so sure about the Edwards endorsement, though. I watched an interview with Elizabeth Edwards, and she was very her number one issue is health care, or at least so she said during that interview. And she liked Hillary Clinton's health care plan better than Barack Obama.
Well, Edwards' health care plan was very similar to Clinton's.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton and Edwards would cover everybody, even if it required you to take some money out of your wages to do it. Obama would not cover everybody. I agree with Clinton and Edwards, because I think when you don't cover everyone, you have a free rider problem, that same economic problem that I see with pure socialism, which is people will say, oh, I'm healthy, I'm fine, and then they suddenly come down with a disease, or they get in a car accident and they need health care, and what do? We're not going to let them die, so we pay for them. Well, that's not fair to the people who've paid in. So I actually... In fact, my biggest negative on Barack Obama is health care. I do think Clinton's right on that, and I've always said that all along. I think he's got other qualities that trump that position. But if your greatest concern is health care and you're an Edwards supporter, as Elizabeth Edwards is, then she's going to agree with Clinton, because Clinton and Edwards' plans were virtually identical. So I understand that. My guess is that John Edwards probably favors Obama a bit. I just, based on the way those debates early on in the campaign, I kind of got the feeling he was a little more pro-Obama than pro-Hillary. So you may have a case where Elizabeth is more pro-Hillary and he's more pro-Obama, and maybe that's why he's staying out of it. I suspect at the end of the day, Edwards will make his endorsement when it makes a difference, and the only way it can make a difference is at the very, very end. You know, when Obama is ahead but doesn't have those last bit of delegates, I think then he'll say that he's choosing Obama, but doing so to end the process and to make a nominee. And that's what I suspect will happen with him.
Yeah.
But thanks for your call. It was a very good call.
Well, thank you. And
I appreciate it. Call in again sometime.
Yeah, I'm glad you answered my question. And I'm not so sure about Al Gore. You know that? He has one major flaw, in my opinion.
That he chose Lieberman.
Yeah.
You know, Gore chose Lieberman when at a very different time. I mean, in hindsight, clearly it was a bad idea. But at the time, this was before the Iraq War had happened. Lieberman was far more of a typical Democrat. And you know, still on domestic issues, people give Lieberman a very hard time. But on domestic issues, he's really not that different from the other Democrats. Now, obviously, on foreign policy, he's way different and votes with Republicans consistently, and that's why Ned Lamont ran against him and beat him in the Democratic primary in Connecticut. But, you know, Al Gore picked him before the Iraq War at a time when Lieberman wasn't seen as that different. So I'll just to give a little bit, you know, before you attack my man Al, I just, you know, give him a little bit of, at least in 2000, Lieberman really wasn't seen as that wayward a Democrat. He was seen as a more conservative Democrat, like a Dianne Feinstein Democrat, and I think Al Gore was trying to reach to the middle to get elected. But I don't think anyone could have foreseen the transformation of Joe Lieberman. At least I certainly didn't.
Right. Well,
thanks for your call, Lilo. I appreciate it.
Before I get off, I want to say I'm waiting for a candidate. I want to replace my Kerry Edwards sticker on the back of my car.
Right.
Right.
Well, at this point, Mark Levine gives you permission to put Obama. I don't see him losing the nomination. If you have to scrape it off your car, I will take full responsibility. At this point, I think Obama is safe. I really do. Thanks for your call, Lilo.
Thank you.
Let me just close. I want to close, though. We only got a few minutes left, by talking about Mildred Loving. You maybe never heard of Mildred Loving. She died last week. Mildred Loving is an African-American woman who in 1958 married Richard Loving. Her name was Mildred Jeter. She married Richard Loving. And at the time, it was illegal in their home state of Virginia for the two of them to get married. So she went to the District of Columbia, where it was legal, and married the white man, Richard Loving, then. She then moved back to Virginia. And in 1958, the county sheriff and two of his deputies broke into their bedroom, literally broke into their bedroom of the newlywed couple, and arrested them for violating Virginia's, quote, Racial Integrity Act, unquote. Now, Virginia was kind. They said that they would not go to prison as long as they left Virginia and didn't return for 25 years. 38 American states, 38 states had miscegenation laws. Miscegenation is race mixing. 38 states prohibited blacks and whites from marrying. That's three-quarters of them. That's enough to have a constitutional amendment. It's funny when you think about people who want a constitutional amendment today to keep gay people from marrying. There were enough states to prevent blacks and whites from marrying. And Mildred Jeter Loving and her husband Richard Loving decided to break the law of Virginia. The case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Actually, first, I should say, it went up to the Virginia court. And the Virginia judge upheld the Racial Integrity Act. This is an interesting opinion if you ever should read it. He said that if God had meant for blacks and whites to mix, he would have placed them on different continents. He would not have placed them on different continents. In other words, Europeans and Africans should not mix. They were on different continents. Nowhere in his opinion is it mentioned that the European and the African descendant went to America, a place where the Native Americans were wiped out, to consummate their marriage. If a European and an African shouldn't get married on American soil, let me suggest to you that no European or African or descendant thereof should. Only Native Americans should get married. The judge didn't take that one. But it went up to the United States Supreme Court. And every law student remembers the famously, wonderfully named case, Loving v. Virginia. It's an irony. Today, Virginia has a state motto. Virginia is for lovers. No, it's not. Loving is against Virginia. And Loving beat Virginia in 1967. And I want to mourn Mildred Jeter Loving today. And to say just briefly, because we don't have much time left, that when Barbara Walters comes on air and talks about her relationship with an African-American senator, Edward Brooke, Republican of Massachusetts,